On Christmas Eve, 1914, a gruesome war was briefly interrupted by a number of spontaneous truces. Up and down the battle line that stretched across western France, groups of combatants, the Germans on one side, the English and their allies on the other, met in no man's land to acknowledge Christmas. They listened to each other sing carols, they traded gifts, and on the pocked fields between their respective lines of barbed wire and filthy trenches, they played soccer. In Silent Night, the story of the World War I Christmas truce, Stanley Weintraub recounts tales of those unlikely events which were dismissed as an aberration of no consequence in the official histories of the war because the truce only lasted a matter of hours and because the war went on for four more years. In December of 2002, I spoke with Mr. Weintraub and asked him if the Christmas truce should have been so dismissed.
It was of utterly no consequence as far as ending the war was concerned. But had the war ended at that time, there would have been perhaps 20 million fewer dead. A generation of young men would not have been wiped out. Perhaps the world would have been a great deal different. We have no way of knowing. But it represents something else, too. It seems to me to be the last gasp of chivalry in wartime, the last gasp of real brotherhood, the recognition that the people on the other side were like you. And one of the most famous songs remembering the Christmas truce is one by John McCutcheon called Christmas in the Trenches. In it, a trooper from Liverpool says that one thing we learned in the Christmas truce was that on both ends of the rifle, we're the same. And I don't think that recognition has occurred since.
And one by one on either side walked into no man's land. With neither gun nor bayonet, we met there hand to hand. We shared some secret brandy and wished each other well. And in a flare-lit soccer game, we gave him hell.
It's probably hard for most people today to imagine how dreadful the conditions in the trenches during World War I were. You quote one German artist who calls the battlefront the work of the devil.
Yes, this was Otto Dix, described the landscape of fortified ditches as lice, rats, barbed wire, fleas, shells, bombs, underground caves, corpses, blood, liquor, mice, cats, artillery, filth, bullets. Mortars, fire, steel, that's what war is, he said. It's the work of the devil. And the troops were grateful for this interlude to celebrate Christmas. It was certainly spontaneous. The governments had no idea that this was going to happen. When they encouraged a bit of morale-boosting gifts to be sent to the troops, and the Germans even sent small Christmas trees, the British were first baffled and then mesmerized by seeing those lights like footlights in a theater across the expanse of no man's land. And it was not a big expanse. No man's land wasn't any wider than the width of a football field from spectators on one side to spectators on the other.
Right.
That meant that the troops could hear each other, could see each other, even shoot at each other almost point blank. It was death to raise your head above a trench. But the Germans, with their Christmas trees, not only lit the candles on the trees, but began singing Silent Night. And the British recognized Silent Night. It was their song, too. And pretty soon, carols and other songs began wafting across the trenches from side to side. You couldn't have done anything in no man's land, even at the time of the truce, without getting rid of the corpses. No man's land might have been only 65 or 70 yards wide, but over the weeks of war, it had filled with corpses. Christmas morning, they buried the bodies jointly. There were moving, informal services. Both sides recognized that they knew the 23rd Psalm. It was repeated in German and in English. The bodies were buried. And once the bodies were buried, they had a football pitch, a soccer pitch.
They had a place where they could play soccer. And whose idea was it initially to have a competition at soccer?
I think it happened spontaneously up and down the line. It was the working man's game.
Mm-hmm.
They longed for that opportunity. The Scott troops kilted in that terrible weather. The Scott troops even brought soccer balls into the trenches and hoped for a chance to use them.
You write of the war itself, quote, "Both sides were misled by half-truths. Beneath the artificial hatred, each respected the other. Victory, if it came at all, would be long delayed, costly, and worthless. Perhaps a football match, after which both sides went home, might be a better solution." And I gather there were soldiers on both sides who felt that way.
Yes, William Dawkins of the East Kents recalled, "It was told to me that our lieutenant colonel threatened our soldiers with machine guns. Mm. Had one of those big mouths," he meant upper-level officers, "gathered together 10,000 footballs, what a happy solution that would have been without bloodshed."
What a beautiful thought.
Of course, it didn't happen. There were nearly four more years of war, three more Christmases of war. There never was another Christmas truce. There hasn't been another one in the history of warfare before or since. And millions died and nothing gained because the peace led to another war in 1939, the Second World War.
Of the truce, at one point in the book, you write, "Christmas 1914 evokes the stubborn humanity within us and suggests an unrealized potential." I know you wrote those words some years ago, but I wonder if you feel they have particular meaning once again now.
I think they have meaning that is ironic in the circumstances, because we can only have truces of the sort that were celebrated by those men in 1914 at Christmas when you have a common culture across the no man's land, when the troops believe in the same thing, have the same backgrounds roughly. And you could do that then because not only did both sides sing Silent Night, for example, the Germans were even able to sing Tipperary in German back to the British. And but how can you do that with a culture that is alien? I was a young officer in the Korean War. We had no common contacts. They didn't talk our language. They didn't look like us. They didn't sound like us. There was nothing we had that was in any way compatible. The same thing could certainly be said of a potential war in Iraq or a potential war anywhere where there isn't a commonality of culture.
There is the commonality of soccer, though, interestingly enough. The Koreans play soccer. The Iraqis play soccer. The U.S., the English, they all play soccer. There
yes,
is kind of the hope of that kind of commonality, perhaps.
It is the world game, certainly. When they talk about the World Cup, it means something about soccer. But I don't recall any attempt to play soccer between the two sides in Korea. I was there for two Christmases during the war. Nothing like that ever happened. I don't know if that attempt was even thought of. Maybe now that there has been a revival of interest in that Christmas truce, we'll think about that again.
That was Stanley Weintraub talking with me in December of 2002 about his book Silent Night, The Story of the World War I Christmas Truce, published by Plume Press.
We shared some secret brandy and wished each other well. In a flare-lit soccer game, we gave him hell. We traded chocolates, cigarettes, and photographs from home. These sons and fathers far away from families of their own. Young Sanders played his squeeze box, and they had a violin. This curious and unlikely band of men.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our goalie mask, Doc Wayne League, or Honeywell Hill photos, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from folk singer John McCutcheon.
Oh, my name is Francis Tolliver. In Liverpool I dwell. Each Christmas comes since World War I, I've learned its lessons well. But the ones who call the shots won't be among the dead and lame. And on each end of the rifle, we're the same.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting unconventional approaches to transform health and healthcare at rwjf.org/pioneer. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR.